This is your show.
Thank you. So first, I want to accept full responsibility. It was my idea that the psychological barriers would be better broken down if we cast this as a 1960s happening. And, I was explaining to Eva that I missed the 60s the first time because I was studying.
Studying at Berkeley.
But, Eva's attire is much more lovely than mine, but this is actually genuine. Dennis Sullivan gave this to me, and he assures me that he bought it in 1967 on Telegraph Avenue. So it's a real hippie vest.
I bought this today at UCSB, so. But this was free.
Oh, cool. So. Let's see, Eva and I did not rehearse, so we don't know exactly, I don't know exactly where we stand. I did make some notes of some old facts about three manifolds that I thought physicists should be told and reminded of. A kind of a list of now known facts, things that follow immediately from geometrization that just should be called to mind. Small list of things that are sort of nearly complete, and then areas where three-manifold topologists have made a lot of progress and might be able to answer questions. So I'd like to kind of get that out. What do you have? What do you want to do?
Well, I'm happy to do that, which is what you suggested before, and then try and direct it toward what might be sort of physical questions. I also, there's some applications that we already have in mind that we could talk about too, but why don't you start? Everybody else should chime in liberally. I mean,
For one thing, I have to say I'm not...
Or conservatively.
I'm not an expert.
No, that's not allowed.
So I'll just try to go through these facts. What I think of as facts, maybe there's some mistakes included, quickly, and just put them on the board. Why don't I wear this while I'm putting on the facts, and I'll put it back on the table. So this is just sort of a little bit of a random smattering, but if we want to think of hyperbolic three manifolds as some kind of physical process, David in his first lecture, said as some kind of replacement for the Feynman diagrams, we might want to sort of thicken these things up and think of the inputs and outputs as cusps and the belly of the interaction as a hyperbolic three manifold. I just want to point out that cusps do have some structure, which is, usually written the Greek letter tau. And many people will be familiar with this. Tau is the letter used for anything modular. It's tau is a complex number in this domain. And it describes the shape of a Euclidean torus. If you normalize one direction to be 1, then the other direction is tau. So the point is, in mathematical language, a cusp has what's called a Euclidean similarity structure. So Euclidean structure would just mean like a Euclidean flat torus if you took the cusp and chopped it off. And the reason for this word similarity is there's really no way of knowing where you should chop off the cusp, so the torus changes its scale. But it has this interesting geometry. Tori are flat things. They're Euclidean space modulo a discrete group Z plus Z. But the group can be put in different ways, different lattices. So there might be a rectangular cusp. It might be a skewed cusp. And these are intrinsic things. So, if you have some theory where the cusp play a role, then you should know that. Another quick point is that hyperbolic volumes of the volumes of hyperbolic three manifolds are well ordered. Now, what well ordered means is you can only hop down a finite number of times before you get to 0. Or the smallest one. So if you write the hyperbolic volumes in increasing order, here's the real number, you'll see sort of a spectrum that has accumulation points from below. That's usually where a cusp is happening. And you can have other accumulation points, and you can have pretty rich structure because you can have two cusps, so you could have accumulation points of accumulation points. But such things, you know, can only get so bad, and one of the ways of expressing that it's not too bad is that it's well-ordered, that you can only take a finite number of jumps downward until you reach the bottom. Now, some people might want to turn volume into an action, and I just want to say that this is a little troubling because of the cusps. You know, you get infinitely many manifolds with almost exactly the same volume, so things you're writing down are not going to converge too well. And I want to point out, I did a little research on this question, but this is still in the category of old facts. Even if you try to beat the cusps by taking the sum of e to the minus volume over hyperbolic three manifolds with injectivity radius greater than a constant. So this completely removes you from the cusps, and you only consider manifolds so that no essential loop is shorter than 10. Even if you consider such a set of hyperbolic manifolds, this sum will diverge. So if you try to take the volume of the manifold M, sum over all the manifolds, it will be a divergent sum. And as far as I know, it's not extremely divergent. As far as I know, maybe you can fix this by adding a log term. So maybe e to the minus volume m log m, a log volume, maybe to the 1 plus epsilon power, this might work.
And if you do include the cusps, what happens?
Well, if you do include the cusps, then you get infinitely many terms with the same volume, so I don't think there's any hope.
Yeah.
Is the problem with your first sum that you somehow not staying equally far from all the cusps? Or is it
no, this is just, don't worry about cusps. Cusps are gone in this problem. This comes from, there's an old study. In fact, I got a book out of the library by Lubotsky called Subgroup Growth. It's a classical subject in group theory. You take a big group, like the free group, and you ask how many groups are there of index m in that as a function of m. It turns out for the free group on two generators, the answer is approximately n factorial. So if you have a group, a Kleinian group k, which maps to the free group, you can compose this into finite groups and construct lots of subgroups here in this hyperbolic manifold group. So the fact that they're growing faster than exponentially, and all these, you see, the point is, if you have a fixed hyperbolic manifold and you look at the groups, subgroups of its fundamental group of index m, all those correspond to finite sheeted coverings that have identical volume. So if there are more than exponentially many of those in m, this is going to be a problem. So anyway, this is, so maybe, you know, maybe physicists have to think of some better action than volume. Maybe e to the minus volume is the action. I don't know. But this is just a warning. Okay, that's the old facts. Just a very quick list of things that we now know. Well, we know that most logical problems evaporate. We can solve the word problem, the triviality problem, the isomorphism problem, so I'm told.
In dimension 3, right?
All this is dimension 3. This is, yeah, for pi 1 of 3 manifolds. So this is nice. I mean, we won't get caught in some Turing machine paradox in three-dimensional world. Now, three manifolds are almost by Perelman reduced to homotopy theory. Of course, it can't be quite so because always Lens spaces, you know, you can have homotopy equivalent Lens spaces that are not homeomorphic. But there's a version, an old version that goes back to Whitehead of called simple homotopy theory. And it's, I believe it's now true that what's called simple homotopy type is the same thing as diffeomorphism. Simple homotopy theory is a version of homotopy theory where instead of deforming maps continuously, you start with triangulated spaces, and you have certain simple operations where, like, if you see a face like this, you can erect a pyramid on it, and you end the inverse operation. So Whitehead built a theory based on expansions and collapses, which is very close. It basically is homotopy theory plus some K-theory information. It's also known now that pi 1 of any 3 manifold is residually finite. Which is an extremely powerful tool. It means that you can understand any element in the group inside a finite quotient. And it has a geometric equivalence, which says basically that you can form very huge finite covering spaces. Basically, anything, any bit, any way you want to unwrap the manifold in a finite covering, any way you could have unwrapped the manifold in an infinite covering, you can still unwrap a big, that same big piece of it. It's like if you're kind of trying to like read the Talmud or something and unscrolling, you can unroll as much as the manifold as you want in a finite cover. And then we also know a lot about K-theory of the fundamental groups and property T. I'll skip those unless there are questions. In the category of near complete, I think we know a whole lot about the space forms of the other seven geometries. So Conway and his collaborators, for instance, recently have posted papers on funny-sounding things like platy cosms.
Sorry, what does space forms mean?
Oh, just what you were talking about. You know, there are these seven geometries, so finite volume manifolds modeled on one of the seven geometries. Usually people say spherical space forms, but I'm allowing flat space forms, nil space forms, whatever. Platy cosm, flat world or something. So this might surprise you, but the complete understanding, the correct description of the manifolds modeled by Euclidean space, you would think it would go back to Beaverbach, but apparently there are some mistakes, and the exact correct list with all the identical ones correctly identified and so on is in some recent papers of Conway and collaborators.
Isn't this the wallpaper group story?
Yes. I mean, there's extra information in here. For instance, he wants to know which pairs are isospectral and things like that.
I see.
But what I'm suggesting is, 99% of the story is quite old from the early part of the, you know, Beaverbach and so on. But there are still six other geometries, and I don't know exactly what the status is. But I suspect it shouldn't be that hard to give a classification of the compact forms for the geometries. That's just my guess. Someone who knows it's hard should jump in and correct me. Just in case the physicists would need to know, we might be able to do that. That's all I'm saying. And then in the last category, where I'd say lots known, but nowhere complete, are questions about volumes of hyperbolic manifolds, if they should become important for some kind of action. Of hyperbolic three manifolds. So these questions arise in, I think, at least six different varieties, because you can ask for just manifolds. You might allow the manifold to be unoriented, which could make it smaller, because the manifold might have an orientation reversing symmetry and then be half the size. So you might, if you're really interested in small things, you might go to the unoriented. manifolds. And if you really want something small, something that, you know, you might have passed over the first time, but if you look at orbifolds instead of manifolds, if you allow yourself to divide out by, you know, finite group symmetries fully, you can get things that are like about a tenth the size, I think, of the manifolds. So orbifold is another category. I think the manifolds have volume order 1 and the orbifolds order a tenth, roughly.
But they still have lower bounds.
Oh, what's that?
Is lower,
yeah, there is a lower bound. There is a lower bound. And then each of these three things, there's a cusped version.
So what about just the question of which of these admit an orbifold action?
Which manifolds admit an orbifold action?
Yeah, is that...
I would guess it, that using, you know, SNAP-P computer program and other tools, that if you have a particular manifold and you want to know what its symmetry, three manifolds, you want to know what its symmetries are, that's pretty doable. So, you know, as Daryl mentioned in his talk, we're a long way from proving which is best and so on, but we have a lot of empirical information, great computer tools and so on. Okay, this is basically my list. The last thing I wanted to suggest is, if one is thinking about hyperbolic manifolds, it might be helpful to organize them into a single metric space. And I think an amusing way to do this would be with the Gromov-Hausdorff topology. So I'll just leave a final suggestion I wrote down here in my notes, an interesting complete metric space. So it would be a discrete, well, not quite discrete, because it would have these cusped manifolds as cluster points, but the idea is that the points in the metric space would be hyperbolic manifolds. And if you want to know what the distance is between two of them, you use this Gromov-Hausdorff distance, where, you know, basically what this means is you take the two spaces, two metric spaces, and you try to line them up in some huge ambient world as close as they can come. And then the sort of the distance between them is, so think of putting them in Rn for a very large n and try to line them as close as they can come to each other. And then the distance is the minimum of the two quantities, the tubular neighborhood that you have to create around one to contain the other, and the symmetric thing, tubular neighborhood of this one to contain that. And Gromov, following Hausdorff's ideas, proves this is gives a metric on metric spaces. So, and I think it's possible to see pretty closely what things look like near the cusp with the Dehn filling. So you can start to get a handle on this space, and it just might be interesting to know, you know, like what its properties are, coarse properties like lambda 1 and things like that.
In physics, the kind of sensing of the light limit space of these things, usually we ask whether there are physical transitions between them.
Okay,
and so I'm not sure if embedding them in a higher dimensional space would accomplish that, but we would be interested in the kinds of topology changing transitions that you can go from one of these to another. And those were
things called generalized Dehn surgery singularity. So you can, there are more metrics. If you have allow metrics with a singularity, then this becomes a connected space. You have
cone
manifolds.
Or Dehn surgery singularity is even more general. And then,
so in between here, there's some singular guide that you go through and you see it over.
But that. What does that cone space look like exactly? I mean,
if you have a single cusp, then there are nearby metrics where it doesn't quite go into the cusp, but maybe there's a very short geodesic returning already.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other ones where actually you have a one-for-one point compactification. So it's a hyperbolic manifold of a complex set in a singular set, either a single point or a circle. And in the case it's a circle with a cone angle or orthogonal to the circle.
Oh, okay, so this is describing what points in the space look like. Is anything known about what the space looks like?
Only locally. That's something you can some finite dimensional space locally, but globally, I don't think.
I mean, questions like, you know, whether it's amenable or, you know, what lambda one of the Laplacian functions would look like.
Yeah, no, I don't think that, I don't know of any actual studies about that space.
Okay.
Well, maybe I could take some of your points and do a little bit of physical interpretation of where they might apply, and then it might stimulate questions that we want more specifically to get answered. So so the first thing we talked about, I think, correct me if I'm getting this right, is these cusps, which locally are kind of a Euclidean ADS sort of metric. Where you have a flat metric on a torus cross section. So the first question is: I assume that this generalizes. I mean, I know that this metric generalizes to higher dimensions, and this phenomenon of cusps appearing as a kind of clustering phenomenon would generalize to, say, six-dimensional hyperbolic spaces. Is that something that is known?
Let's see, something that doesn't generalize, right?
Right, yeah. The set of hyperbolic manifolds in higher dimensions, the volumes are discrete, there are no limits, so you don't get...
Oh, interesting. See, this is just really specific to three dimensions?
Yeah, very specific to dimension three.
So are there no cusp structures?
There are cusps, but you can't take a sequence of closed six hyperbolic manifolds with the geodesic getting shorter and shorter and a cusp developing. That doesn't happen.
This geometry exists. By geodesic getting shorter and shorter, are you talking about the cycles of this torus?
That exists, but he was talking about this accumulation.
Right.
Cut off the cusp farther and farther out.
Right.
Hyperbolic three manifolds. And that's the thing that doesn't.
That does not extend.
I think also, in higher dimensions, the cusps are more general, right? They can be no manifolds.
Yeah.
You mean
they're
the
not
cross
necessarily
section?
Flat. They're not quite flat. They have nil geometries.
Okay. But this is a constant curvature metric.
I'm saying within a constant minus one curvature metric, you have a six-dimensional hyperbolic manifold.
Yeah.
It might have a cusp, but the geometry of the section of the cusp is not flat, but nil.
Okay.
So that possibility doesn't even exist in three dimensions because there's no nil geometries in dimension two.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that was very useful for me to know that you can't.
Do you know roughly why that is? I'm trying to remember.
It will take a couple of minutes to come back to. There's a simple reason.
You're asking at this point why why doesn't it happen?
Too, but I can't quite reconstruct the argument. Why you can't limit to. We should just go on. Daryl, interrupt us.
Definitely do interrupt us when you find out, because so the application I have in mind is from the point of view of the physics of string theory, where there are extra dimensions and the extra ones need to be compactified or at least have finite volume. And this kind of hyperbolic space being so generic means that it's something that we should consider and understand. And so we would like to get a grasp of what are the generic phenomena that you have geometrically. So if this isn't one, that's good to know. Of course, it will happen some of the time, so you could consider the product of two three manifolds if you want to start in 10 dimensions and compactify down to 4 dimensions. And this phenomenon will happen.
It will happen.
Because.
But of course, that doesn't admit a six-dimensional hyperbolic metric.
No. It's some special case.
The basic point, actually, is if you just have a very short geodesic in a six-manifold, then a neighborhood of it is that short circle times a five-dimensional disk. So the boundary of that neighborhood is a circle times a four-dimensional sphere. And it ought to have been a five-dimensional torus, but it's not. Mm-hmm. It's a product of a circle and a small sphere. And so you're not getting something that looks like a cusp, which should have been a five-dimensional torus.
Wait, I'm sorry. If I just try and go the other way, I start with this metric, which I can write in any dimension. Yeah. You're saying I can't continue it, close it off in a way that respects.
I think what Daryl's saying is that in three dimensions, uniquely, mm-hmm. the neighborhood of a small geodesic, so you have a compact manifold, no cusp, but you have a very short geodesic, 10th of an inch long. The boundary of its neighborhood looks a lot like a truncated cusp, because what is the boundary of the neighborhood? It's just a torus, right? But in higher dimensions, that boundary of the neighborhood is not a torus, it's a circle across a high-dimensional sphere. So it's looking very uncusp-like. It's looking like it has positive scalar curvature.
So having a short geodesic in three dimensions, you're likely to be able to find it and move sort of out toward the end of the cusp. But in higher dimensions, it would be someplace else in the map.
But Daryl, why couldn't you have like a short torus instead of a short circle?
That's the...
That's the commute. You can't have...
That's the Margulis.
Margulis thing, small as a billion.
If you have two short loops, I mean, you can't have two short loops because they won't quite commute, and then the group won't be discrete. And mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, in any case, we'd like to understand these manifolds for many reasons, and in particular, stabilize them. So this rigidity statement that you've taught us is probably important for that. One general question is how powerful that is. Do I have so there's a gap spectrum here. And if I do include the cusps, it's still gapped. Is the gap just dependent on the curvature, or does it vary with the length of
it? Doesn't vary with the length.
It doesn't vary with the length. Okay. So we have a spectrum that includes the volume mode, the zero mode, and then a gap of order one over the curvature radius, R naught, let's call it.
What's R naught?
The curvature radius of the space, let's say.
Are these constant curvature minus one spaces?
Yeah, but it's some value for the physics. Physicists in the audience, this is dimensionally just the KK spectrum, and the claim is that these are rigid, so is that good enough for stabilizing the moduli of this thing to just fix the volume? And in string theory, in addition to the volume, we have the string coupling, which is an extra scalar field that's involved near weak coupling. So I don't know quite what question to ask, but I think
are we in dimension three or a general dimension right now?
We're in a general dimension, but perhaps most simply you could consider starting from 10 dimensions and go down to 4 on something that's six dimensional, which could be a product of two of these, given that we know most about them, or something higher dimensional. So this rigidity statement is a higher dimensional statement, if I remember right.
Rigidity is higher dimensional. But there's a caution. I don't know if this affects the physical arguments. It was pointed out by Gromov about 10 years ago that one shouldn't expect the pattern to continue past dimension 3, where topological spaces or manifolds are described by special metrics. I mean, there's the argument has to do with some B diff getting infinite homotopy, infinitely many homotopy groups. I'd have to think to reconstruct the argument, but there's good reason to believe that 3 is the last case where we can expect a manifold taken at random to have anything interesting in terms of geometry. So, in other words, I'm just cautioning that if you're thinking about six-dimensional manifolds, you shouldn't think that they break up into nice, Einstein metrics on different pieces and so on. You probably just have a lot of gobbledygook.
You're saying there's not an analog of this Ricci flow separation into a few simple geometries?
Yes, there should not be.
Fair enough. So it seems like a very difficult problem to classify the statistics of these things more generally. But this is a lot more general than string theorists have thus far tended to consider. So I think it's interesting to see what comes out generically just in this class, since you know so much about them.
But is it reasonable to think that the physics picks out hyperbolic manifolds or manifolds with some special geometry, and that you won't have to pay attention to the average manifold that has lousy geometry?
Well, if the average manifold is also rigid in this sense...
I didn't quite understand the sense of rigid.
Okay, the sense of... So what one would like to have is a... Okay, so, let me explain in a physics language and see if that's good enough for the mathematician. So one considers, let's say we start in a 10-dimensional theory with an action that is the Einstein action, which is just given by the curvature plus other contributions that we'll ignore. So if you compactify on a 6-dimensional space, then you end up with a...
For mathematicians, this is the Hilbert
right?
Einstein-Hilbert action.
Just a partisan remark.
Okay. So what you get in 4 dimensions is, you know, some theory, which is, again, covariant, and which has a bunch of degrees of freedom in it inherited from this. So here I'm drawing the 4 dimensions in this direction and the 6 dimensions as some compact space. The 4-dimensional theory has degrees of freedom corresponding to the metric modes of the interval space. And those transform in 4 dimensions as scalar fields. So there are a bunch of scalar fields in the problem descending from the compact space. One of them is clearly the volume of the space. Okay, so let me just call that mode rho or something. So it has some kinetic energy, and it has a potential energy.
And it's thought of as a function on the 4-dimensional space.
And it's thought of as a function on the 4-dimensional space. Or it's a functional, it's a function of the field. Rho is a function of the 4-dimensional coordinates x. And one nice thing about the negative curvature case is that it gives us a positive contribution to the potential energy if you keep your signs straight. And in the real world, if you consider the kind of potential energy for scalar fields that we need to have to model the real world, the simplest version of this is something like this, where there's a net positive potential energy at which the scalar fields can sit in this stable minimum of the potential, or metastable minimum of the potential, local minimum.
So that would be like a preferred volume?
It would be like a preferred volume. And all we get so far from the metric is really just this leading positive piece. So actually, I should really think about it in this way. As you go towards large volume, as rho goes to infinity, the potential goes to zero because the curvature goes to zero. But it's a positive contribution, so you get this first term in a potential energy that you need to use to stabilize the scalar field in this volume mode. So the nice thing, so there are other ingredients we can add to this system to produce the negative term and the third term that I've written here, which I won't go into, although it's related to these questions about unoriented and orbifolded spaces. And so negative curvature is nice because it's generic and because you want a positive potential energy. But it is important to very carefully stabilize all of the possible scalar fields descending from metric modes on this space. So the statement of rigidity seems very promising if, in fact, I'm interpreting it correctly as saying that among these various deformations of the metric, which could be quite complicated, they're all massive except for this volume mode, which has a tadpole. A potential energy descending from the curvature in the obvious way. So maybe I should pause here and ask, is this, first of all, the correct interpretation? Maybe someone who's bilingual can...
So I think one thing that might confuse topologists is I think you're using rigid in the sense that they're that's different from what they're thinking. That is, topologists in connection with three manifolds think of Mostow rigidity, right? And I think that you're talking about a spectral gap for the Laplace and non-functions when you say rigid.
Are these not related to each other? So if I consider a Riemann surface, which has moduli and can be deformed, in that case,
you can create
a zero energy mode describing that motion. So that's why the two seem similar to me.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So, but this is indeed the question.
Okay. Yeah. No, I agree. There's some similarity, but I think I don't know how closely related those are. That is, I think it's true that the Laplacian functions overall hyperbolic, finite volume hyperbolic manifolds has a global lower bound. You know, so another, by going from manifold to manifold, you can't get lower and lower notes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I don't think Mostow rigidity says that. Do you think you can? Oh, maybe you can by taking covers.
The eigenvalues of Laplacian are roughly the same things as the lengths of closed geodesics or the reciprocal.
You can.
Geodesic is your low note, is that right?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So actually, I take back what I said. I mean, after listening to what you were starting to say. So, you know, a good example of hyperbolic manifold is the mapping. Torus or the pseudo-Nassauf map of the surface, and if instead you take the nth power of that, that n go to infinity, this manifold will have, as you say, it's very long to get around that direction, and it'll have low notes.
It sounded like actually high notes is what you are ruling out with this gap. Is that right, short geodesic?
No. I think generally, I mean, a spectral gap is to rule out low notes.
Should correspond to low notes? If it separates, it's the manifold.
Oh, if it separates. Yeah. Oh, right there,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, so that, well, I mean, that you wouldn't find a very small surface separating a three manifold. So in that sense, maybe there's no...
No, you can, in the case of mapping torus, you can find a surface of a constant size that's separating bigger and bigger volumes.
Silly question. That integral S10, is that over all 10-dimensional manifolds?
No, this is just over a single one. Oh, I mean, we'll come back to this point that Michael was making about trying to look at the distribution of manifolds and...
And that second integral, then, that's over a 10-dimensional manifold as well?
This one is over a 4-dimensional manifold. So what I obtained, so this U of rho that I wrote is the integral over the internal space. Let's just call it X6. So
it's basically Fubini's theorem. She's trying to do the integral in two directions.
So the 6-manifold is very small, is that the point?
Yeah, and so physicists like to integrate out the fast modes, they call
it. And so this 10-dimensional manifold's got a metric on it?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's like an S structure, then you won't have negative curvature. You've got these small 6-manifolds.
The negative curvature is what produces this potential energy.
So the negative curvature is in the 4-dimensional direction, but the 6-dimensional
The 6 dimensions, let's say, is negatively curved.
But what about the fact that Clavijau manifolds are... Ricci flat.
That is of course true, and that's a small set of compactifications that you can consider, which have been mostly considered.
I see. So you want to move away from that and think about negatively curved compactifying 6 manifolds.
Right. So in the case of Calabiage,
they couldn't be small.
Sure.
Small is in the eye of the beholder.
I mean,
quite seriously, if 6 dimensions are compact and the 4 dimensions aren't, then if there's a volume scale for the 6-dimensional manifold, then we're free to set that scale at some very small number or some very large number because there's some physical measurement here. So, I mean, you can talk about intrinsic measures like, you know, ratio of curvatures to volumes, things like that. And maybe in that sense, you're right. Maybe these pinching theorems and so on. But,
yeah, I mean, so what Daryl's saying is that if you insist for physical reasons in calling this six-dimensional manifold small, then you've also insisted that its sectional curvature is a tremendously large negative number because you've just rescaled it.
Right.
So is that allowed? I mean, can you have curvature 6 billion minus 6 billion?
In order to obtain a controlled description of this, we need everything to be, the volume to be large and the curvature to be small. So in some fundamental unit. So just to ground this, we can compare to the plot length, which is some unobservably small number, okay, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So it doesn't matter that we are going to take the volume and to be very large, the curvature radius to be very large in these units. I'm not sure I'm addressing the question, but indeed we want it to be somewhat large.
But I think Daryl says a good point because there might be, I mean, I don't know what the answers are in high dimensions, but I don't know if anyone knows, but it might be that if you want the curvature to be minus one for this six-dimensional manifold, that it's just going to have such large diameter that you can exclude it by physical argument.
So I wish it were that powerful, but we're dealing with really small numbers here. So, how big is that? What is this ratio? Actually, again, so what is the ratio of the diameter to the curvature radius? You're saying there's a limit on that as a function of
curvature radius. Oh, I see. That means the okay. So I would guess that if you have a hyperbolic six-dimensional manifold, its diameter is bigger than one.
Bigger than the curvature radius. Is that what's being said?
What's your length scale?
What's the diameter of the smallest three manifolds we have?
The smallest three manifold must be more than 0.1 because its volume is more than 0.1.
Your normalization is that the curvature is constant minus 1.
Yeah.
So that's what's setting the scale.
But saying that the diameter is bigger than the curvature radius is no big deal.
Yeah, but let me just point out, it's a notoriously hard thing to construct hyperbolic manifolds at all past dimension 4. And in fact, when I was a student of this subject, which was long ago, Dennis Sullivan pointed out that you had to know number theory to make any example. In dimension 3, you could do naive things with, you know, polyhedra in space and expand them. But you really needed to use a little number theory to get, like, in four dimensions. And, you know, when you start using number theory, you very quickly are using, like, Selberg lemma and things like this, and you're going to big covers. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the answer wasn't diameter 1, but diameter, you know, 10 to the 50. In other words, you know, this is really puts spotlight on our ignorance, I think, is maybe hyperbolic six-dimensional manifolds are huge things. I don't know.
That would be very interesting to know.
Well, Jeff, I think in low dimensions, meaning less than about 10, there's a few simple examples like coming from simplexes. I think there's a few things known, but once you get beyond dimension 14 or something, it's all arithmetic.
Happily, string theorists don't care much beyond dimension 10.
Is that right?
So there are non-arithmetic examples in dimension 4?
Well, now these examples are probably arithmetic.
Yeah. Those are flat.
Specific geometric constructions, I think.
Well,
I
didn't know those. Okay. There are others.
No, that's true.
Unfortunately, we don't have
Do they make orbifolds or manifolds?
Well, it's usually an orbifold.
And then you go to some... So you might have to go to a pretty huge cover. I don't know. Well, that sounds like, if anyone's taking notes, that sounds like a point to track down how the volume of the smallest guys or the diameter of the smallest guys grows with dimension.
And you know enough to know that, the answer to that?
Well, it might be that they're, you know, some experts, like Bill.
So what about the statement, you explained carefully what's meant by the statement that hyperbolic geometries are most generic in dimension 3. this business of the
filling and all that? Most three manifolds in some sense have a hyperboloid metric and not one of the other seven.
Right. Is that a statement you expect to generalize to higher dimensions?
No. As Mike said, in high dimensions, most manifolds won't have any geometric structure at all. And then if you ask amongst the ones that do have a geometric structure, mm-hmm. actually I think there are lots of spherical six manifolds, and there might be more spherical six manifolds than hyperbolic in some sense.
But isn't the kinds of fundamental groups you can get in possibly curved spaces really
very
limited?
Very limited. But so there are infinitely many. And
it's hard to believe that because, of course, it's hard to quantify these things, but since for the sphere you have a compact group and you're asking for, discrete subgroups of a compact group versus, cofinite volume subgroups of an infinite group. For example, once you found one Kleinian group in high dimensions, you can just make this huge slew of finite index coverings. So you can't do that from the spherical case. You run out very fast.
Yeah, you can go in the other direction, though. Those covers make the hyperbolic manifold bigger, but with spherical manifolds, you can make them smaller by quotienting out by bigger and bigger cyclic groups.
I think it's... Anyway, maybe the main point is it's probably apples and oranges. It's probably... I don't think there's probability measure on any of this, so I don't think we can say conditioned on the fact that it has a geometric structure.
So what was your conclusion about the gap? Are you saying it's known that there is a gap of this magnitude
at least I didn't understand the question yet about rigidity? I mean, you were asking...
Let me just ask it in terms of this gap, because that's really what we care about.
Okay. Okay, so what's the question? What's the gap?
Yeah. Is there... if I consider perturbations of the metric, according to the Hilbert action, are they all massive with this... So the Hilbert action determines a Laplacian for each mode of the metric, whose eigenvalues I want to know, and I want to know if there's a gap between the zero mode and the higher modes.
And do you think this is equivalent to asking whether the Laplacian on functions with respect to the initial metric is gapped?
You mean on the scalar fields?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But
that's
what you're saying is well known.
Well, I mean, that's well studied. I mean, I don't think anyone could say whether on a typical family of manifolds that's gapped or goes to zero. I mean, it would depend on what's typical. I mean, Daryl and I were just talking about taking covers. If you take covers, this gap goes to zero. If you take the manifold and you pinch a neck, it goes to zero.
Are you talking about the hyperbolic three manifolds?
What I said covers them, but...
Okay, so you're saying there's not a gap in these.
There's not a gap.
She wants to take a single hyperbolic free manifold and ask a question about its spectrum.
Is it the Laplacian or is it the linearized Einstein operator?
Well, I'm ultimately interested in the linearized Einstein operator, right. If you have an answer for the Laplacian.
Yeah, for the linearized Einstein operator, actually, I think there is a gap.
That's universal as you go from one hyperbolic three manifold to another?
In terms of Einstein constant.
Is it Einstein constant?
In terms of the
curvature.
Oh, well, that's minus one.
Right.
So that is a very... I think that's...
Well, so let me ask you...
actually...
Just to test what you're thinking, would that be true if you took a covering space which unwrapped the manifold in some direction? Would this gaps remain, or would it go to zero as you unwrapped it in a longer and longer
way? It will remain, actually.
Are you just looking at the lowest eigenvalue of the linearized operator? Then is there some estimate? If it's negative,
So if you're doing the linearized,
zero.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. So for the, for
okay,
the negative,
it's called
astronomy.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this is I think rather useful if I'm interpreting it correctly, because it's saying that of all these scalars we could have had, most of them are massive. Most of them are already heavy. So if you look in these directions, it's you're sitting at a minimum. And this is also in contrast to the case of Calabi-Yahoo that you brought up, which are more like Riemann surfaces where you specify the manifold, but then you have all these light at the level of this differential geometry of exactly flat directions, exactly massless modes. And the fact that in this case you don't is, if anything, easier. That's the optimistic point of view, but it's something that I think is possibly very important. So. Okay, so this is the kind of application that, this is a very kind of pedestrian application of these spaces within string theory, is to use them in this way as compactifications. And then we might want to know, well, in order to complete this, we would want to know things about the ways that you can project to obtain orbifold, you know, the cases in which you can find Z2 symmetries by which you can orbifold, because the kind of ingredients that you need to put in to get the other terms and the potential energy, in particular this negative term, is something called an orientifold. So you might want to know, you know, under what conditions you can do that. But then once you have this, we would also be very interested in these questions of the statistics of how these spaces are distributed, something like what you were already describing about the clustering of the manifolds to some fixed volume from below. So you say there's an infinite sequence.
Yeah, converging from below.
Converging from below, and that's this cusp getting longer and longer. Is that the
yes, that's a good way of looking at it.
And how does it? How does the number? If I just pick some point here or something, how does the number depend on the length of the cusp?
Let's see. I think the way to think about it, is you have these lattice points in the plane, which describe the possible Dane fillings of the cusp, and if you pick a, say this is the origin, if you pick a divisible lattice point, that actually won't give you a manifold when you fill it. That'll give you an orbifold. It'll be like a 2 pi divided by the divisibility. Uh-huh. But if you look at indivisible points, those will give you manifolds when you fill. And the ones that are farther out will have longer noses, you know. Now, let's see, how does... Do you know, Daryl, the asymptotics of this?
It's something quadratic. I don't know if it's quadratic in the length or... the exponential of the logarithm of the length, it'd be something, I mean, so I mean, if you take a point P comma Q in the plane, yeah. I think what's relevant is the absolute value of P plus the absolute value of Q.
Okay.
So, and you hold that fixed, maybe that's linear in that quantity, but then I'm not quite sure how deep out in the cusp. So if you set that quantity to be a constant, the depth of the cusp is probably either that constant or e to the power of that constant.
Yeah, if I had to guess, I'd guess this one, but I'm not sure. I think I know. One thing we do know is, the Margulis lemma, right, says that if you have something that's of size epsilon here, then you know that you have a. So if you have a geodesic of size epsilon, then you know its tubular neighborhood embeds out to e to the 1 over epsilon, right?
Yeah.
It's the estimate for how big the Margulis tube is. So we could answer Eva's question if we knew when we Dane filled. How the how long that circle was approximately.
I'm
Well, I probably can't do this.
Oh, right, yeah. So maybe the number of possibilities grows exponentially with the cusp, because you think you're looking at a loop on the boundary of that cusp that's a unit area torus. And the length of that curve is like the circumference of the circle. It's like e to the minus 1 over epsilon, actually, I think. It looks like the number of possibilities grows exponentially with L.
Number of possibilities? Oh.
Yeah, because the boundary of the meridian disk of that solid torus could be any loop of length, the circumference at e to the minus 1 over epsilon, I think. This is something that can be found out.
Okay, well, this is interesting for string model building in this kind of sense of doing compactifications, and this kind of nose, or yeah, what we call throat, is something that we've encountered a lot in the context of Calabi-Yau compactifications, but for in a different sense. Just to we encounter a warp. We consider a warped product, so you have some function. So you have some coordinates, y on your Calabi-Yau, and then you have a warped product of your four-dimensional space with the Calabi-Yau. So in the Calabi-Yau, I'll draw the same picture, but now this is a Calabi-Yau. With some other ingredients that come along in string theory, the geometry, this warped geometry, has the feature fairly generically with a similar kind of clustering effect, that this f of y, which is a kind of gravitational redshift effect, gets small near some cusp-like thing, except here, this is a Lorentzian signature space, so it's kind of like the cusp that you were talking about, except yours is Euclidean cross-sections, and these are Lorentzian cross-sections. And for what it's worth, there's a lot of model building to do with brains moving around in these spaces, and I think this same kind of stuff can go on in these perhaps more generic examples, with a similar kind of effective action appearing, but with differences in detail. And anyway, this kind of information will be very useful for that.
So let me ask a generic question.
Yeah.
Is the picture that any possible vibration over the four big dimensions by these little six manifolds can occur, and there'll be some kind of action that we'll compute to then decide if that was probable or improbable, or if it had a large amplitude? I mean, are we kind of doing quantum mechanics where we're going to be talking about superposition of all these different manifolds?
First of all, it's not necessarily true that anything can occur. I mean, there are equations of motion that descend from some action that tell you, what shapes you really get. And then the second question about how you define a probability on this space of these things is wide open. I mean, it's a question that people are thinking about a lot now, but it's difficult.
I mean, the reason I'm asking is, because we were talking about, how the typical manifolds in six dimension aren't this and that, but you might hope that your probability density would concentrate on nice ones for some reason.
Right. Well, I am very interested in whether these statements about all of the fluctuations being massive would pick out some small subset of manifolds. That's one way that could happen. It's from the physical point of view, this is an issue of stability. And more symmetric configurations are guaranteed at least to be extrema of the effective action. And so that's a sense in which they may be more likely. At least they are guaranteed, again, to just at least be solutions. So, yeah, so, but this question of how to sum over manifolds and so on is a fascinating question. But there's not a well-defined understanding of that.
What would you do with it if you could sum over manifolds? What would be the good of it?
Well, it'd address the question that you raised. I mean, the hope would be that there would be some principle that prefers some spaces over others. Indeed, this question of just counting manifolds may well be not the right measure, but is, you know, kind of an input anyway to whatever measure there would be. That's difficult to be concrete about. I'll maybe make one comment about the other point you raised, which is to do with that question, but just
why don't you put this on since you'll be talking over there?
Okay. I don't want to belabor this, but I think it's a really interesting understanding that's developing of how topology and geometry appear in string theory, and there's a new twist to it that may be important for this kind of question. So you're talking about these. Let's keep in dimension three, where we know the hyperbolic ones are generic, and talk about them. And you're asking for a probability measure on how they, something like a Hartle-Hawking wave function or something. But one thing that's probably important in physics, the reason for asking this question is because we don't really understand the initial conditions that might lead us to, even if we're modeling late time physics properly with these kinds of manifolds, we need to understand where they came from. And at a naive level, that's a question about, so first let me say that in this spirit, what you were really thinking about, I think, is that, you know, our four dimensions, our 3+1 dimensions, consist of these hyperbolic three manifolds over which you want to sum. But you're asking about a question about initial conditions, and where did these things come from? What is the probability to get one thing or another? But one thing that's important within the context of physics is that all of this geometrical description breaks down as you get to smaller spaces. And in the context of string theory, so in general, new degrees of freedom can appear in the system and become important. So rather than just focusing on the metric fluctuations, which are certainly part of the story and constitute physical degrees of freedom also in string theory, there are other degrees of freedom, and the most prosaic degrees of freedom that are added are, in fact, so you have general relativity, but you have other things, and in particular you have strings, so you have strings that wind around the cycles of these manifolds. So the fact that mathematicians have known for a long time that the number of these things is a function of length grows exponentially, that the fundamental group goes exponentially, translates in physics into there being a exponential density of states contained in this spectrum of strings wound around these cycles. And this is something which makes a bigger and bigger difference as you go back toward a smaller and smaller space. So here what I'm drawing is time evolution. So I don't want to give a lecture here, but just to give you an idea that the upshot of this, you have more degrees of freedom, and in a rather precise sense, you can show that you get effectively more dimensions as you move back in this direction. So this kind of question about what the right measure is in the full theory is probably better answered in the presence of the degrees of freedom that really matter for the initial times. And again, we're learning a lot about that, and I think that all these mathematical relations are playing a big role. The topology, the, you know, this geometric group theory statement is just one of them that I can explain here easily. So for me, the way I would address this is to first understand the small radius behavior of these things in the full theory using the topology and geometry results from mathematicians, you know, in a way that's consistent with what's going on in the full UV completed theory. So I think this is something I'm very excited about right now, and one of the things that I would want to do is formulate questions that help us understand this phase.
So that picture has nothing to do with the compactified directions? That's just
I would say, you know, another application, which is the one we're talking about in this spirit, is, yeah, these could certainly be R 3 plus 1 dimensions. So
the picture there is near the beginning, string student wind fantastically around the fundamental group because it was so short.
You're so short, exactly. Absolutely.
But then what happens to the strings that are going around very long words when the space is expanded?
They make a small contribution, but it's one that's that you can detect. So the way you the quantity that you use to characterize this is you look at just the spectrum of all string states in the system, so single strings, and you have the usual ones that just, you know, appear in the geometry independently of the winding of the fundamental group, but then you have these other ones. And you ask, what is the total density of states in the deep UV, in the high energy density of states of the system, and you find that even at large radius, although these strings are very long and heavy, they make a contribution to this UV density of states that's still possible, you know, still important. I mean, it's not a large effect, but it's something that allows you to see that this is starting to happen. I should just say, give an example here. If you do, instead of a 3 manifold, if you do a Riemann surface of genus H, then our conjecture, which is based on, I think, quite a bit of evidence by now, is that this space starts out really as a torus of dimension 2H, the Jacobian, with a scalar field that condenses and drives a transition from this to the large radius geometry that we're talking about here. So if anyone wants the full story on this, I can explain it, but probably shouldn't for this session.
Is the Jacobian somehow becomes the surface itself?
Yeah. There's a transition from one to the other, which in itself isn't too surprising. But the point is that these extra degrees of freedom make a big difference and change the character of the system at small radius. We essentially have a path integral argument for this now, so it's something that you can actually show pretty simply. But just broad brush, I'm just saying that these things matter, but they depend on this kind of topology and geometry, so maybe we could pursue that offline.
Sure, definitely.
So the other people should...
In that picture, does a single point in the Jacobian become a Riemann surface, or does the entire Jacobian become one Riemann surface?
Well, it kind of depends what you mean. The system begins with a space-time that includes this whole Jacobian. But as time evolves, I mumbled something about a scalar field driving this transition. So there's some scalar field, let's call it T of X, that you can think of as essentially restricting being a potential. So you have this Jacobian, I don't know how to draw it intelligently, but you have this Jacobian, and there's a potential energy that's introduced by this scalar field living on the Jacobian, which restricts you to the Riemann surface. So in that sense, it's a pretty prosaic thing, but it does involve, you know, it involves more than the metric mode. It's something that you learn about that's specific to this theory. So, you know, basically geometry and topology are related, and they're also related to dimensionality. But again, other people probably have other agendas, other questions.
Yeah. I just raised the one Dave actually mentioned in the first lecture, which is M theory applications. I don't actually have a list of things I'd like to know, but I'm curious if anyone's thought more about this and what kind of questions are useful.
I've been thinking more about it. The basic thing that one might hope to make M theory go is to understand in some detail the late time behavior of Ricci flow for an arbitrary three manifold. But there are going to be some related questions, which thanks to Crown and Billy and Hamilton and later in cleanup some various people, about which I have nothing to say.
Really?
Really. we know pretty well what happens when you start with a compact three manifold. And the one extension that seems to be also under control, I think, although some details have to be checked, is the unorientable case, where slightly funny things can happen, like fixed points of the orientation reversing map can develop. But anyway, that's a case which is also under control. But for M-theory applications, I think we need to know about two other situations. One is manifolds with cusps. So you start out with a cusp, and the question is, let's take finite volume complete metric, right? And let's ask whether the Ricci flow story continues to hold in a similar form. Your initial reaction
it
should be okay, right? But, I mean, Hamilton's theorem of short-time existence isn't even proved, so far as I know. Another situation...
So let me just make a comment about that question. For some paper that Kevin and... Oh, it's actually the paper I was talking about.
Yeah.
It appeared we needed something like this because we wanted to use Perlman after cutting the manifold into geometric pieces. Necessarily, there were cusps present. So... Danny had a very clever way of dealing with this by filling in the manifold, filling in the cusp with some very long loop, and then that's an orbifold.
Right.
And then using the orbifold version, because there's an equivariant, so you can use equivariant version of Perlman. So somehow the analytic questions, at least in our application, could be sidestepped. So there's an interesting analytic question, but for many cases, you might be able to get to the same place by just thinking about that long snout picture where you filled in Dundane surgery on a long curve. So
right. It's
possible you can kind of get where you're going with a crutch.
So that handles well a case of interest in M-theory applications, which is to understand arbitrary Euclidean three manifolds. But there's another equally important case, which is arbitrary Lorentzian three manifolds, where maybe you want to think of the spatial directions as being compact, but you probably don't want the time direction to be compact. And then you'd like to, and now the use of the word time is dangerous, so I'll talk about the evolution parameter differently. But now you'd like to think of letting the Lorentz signature metric evolve according to Ricci flow, and yeah, somebody's shaking his head.
No. So what happens?
I have no idea. I don't even know if you can do short-time existence. I don't know if it's reasonable because of the signature.
So, Dave, this point that Michael was raising about the, you know, the fact that the e to the minus volume is not enough to suppress the huge number of these things, doesn't that affect this idea as well? Or?
Sure. No, that certainly affects the idea. I mean, you know, we don't yet have a real concrete proposal about how to assemble these Ricci flow endpoints into a kind of perturbative version of M theory. I mean, it's a hope that there would be something like that, right? But there's no
right. But I'm just saying that concretely, this point about the huge number seems to me that the partition function just isn't well defined. I mean, it's not the same situation that we have in string theory where, you know,
sure,
although there's a Hegedorn.
He also gave us a possible out, which is.
But that's not the right question.
The action has to be treated very carefully.
Yeah, thank you. I meant to just to summarize this, which is also related to Dave's point. Therefore, these questions should be asked in this framework, and maybe the suppression that you need would come out because of something here. I'm not saying yes or no, but it's a different question, and the fact that you have so many new degrees of freedom may make a difference and change make it more suppressed or something. So, It would be really fun if this didn't make sense, but because of the difference.
Yeah. But the formula that I was suggesting might converge. That was still only in the case when you put a lower bound on injectivity radius, because nothing is going to solve the problem of cusps where you have infinitely many manifolds with almost exactly the same volume. There's not nothing you can do about it.
Well,
but sorry. As you increase this you're not increasing the volume, but you increase this length.
Yeah.
What else happens? What happens with the topology? What? How do these differ?
As you increase the injectivity radius.
Yeah.
You make that constraint.
Yeah. I mean, what else is going on in the sequence of manifolds that you're getting in this way?
Oh, you mean just the cusp filling?
More manifolds qualify. Is the point.
More manifolds, but that means that there are. How does the fundamental group change as you do? Is there some?
Oh, the fundamental group is very easy to understand in this sequence that approaches the cusp.
Uh-huh.
Basically, there's a kind of a parent group, which is the cusped manifold, and that has a z plus z in it, which generally is not allowed, but it's a special case. It's allowed when the z plus z is sitting at infinity.
Right. Okay.
But now to get a compact manifold, that z plus z can't persist, and all that you're doing is you're taking the pq element in that z plus z, uh-huh, and you're adding the relation that's trivial.
Okay.
So all of these are, their fundamental groups are quotient of the cusp manifold group by sending different elements in that z plus z to the identity.
I see. I was just asking to see if the stringy degrees of freedom would be changing as you made this degeneration in some interesting way. But
But there are things like injectivity radius, various kinds of how big is the sectional curvature near the point measurements, which may well be playing an important role in addition to the volume. So it may be that we actually want to do a double sum where we constrain both the volume and something about the curvature.
Well, the curvature is minus one, but you mean the injectivity.
Yeah, injectivity. Well,
normalized by the curvature. Is that what you mean?
That's probably what I mean.
Yeah.
Maybe. Something like that. Understanding what would happen in the Lorentz signature case, I think is maybe one of the bigger obstacles to make.
But that's a good question. Do we have analysts here, Ricci flow people in the room? That's really an analytical question about short time existence to start with.
Right.
I think my guess is that this community, there's this vibrant community of Ricci flow people, and it seems to me at the present they should be hungry for new questions. So I don't think they eat up your Lorentz signature question. You should send Ben Chow an email.
it may be that it just changes the. It's not an elliptic equation anyway, but it makes the equation. It gives it too many plus and too many minus eigenvalues in the PDE.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Anyway, that's.
So we can ask them.
Yeah. Speak up back there.
Well, let me ask it. Not a comedy joke, but a related question. So, might these accumulation points suggest that to do what David wants to do, topology is not really the right creature? That, I mean, we're used to the idea that, physicists have thought about membranes in lambda dimensions, are used to the idea that they fluctuate a lot. It's not clear that they really have a fixed topology. And maybe the path integral David wants to do has some extra degrees of freedom to sort of smooth out over these different topologies that approach the cusp. Mm-hmm. So the question I was asking Joe, which is related, is, as you recall, when you analyze path integrals in various dimensions, via some physics-naive scaling argument, there's some idea that the sort of differentiability of the typical path goes down as you go up. Your quantum mechanics path integral is, it's supported on these sort of path differential functions and things like that. There's some place where it drops below C0. And, you know, I was just wondering if that's between two and three dimensions, and if so, it might be very natural that you lose information about topology going to a three-dimensional path integral. But I can't recall where the transition is or how the scaling goes. So if anybody here remembers...
Well, no, this does ring some bells. I mean, L2-1 is functions for, like for instance, membranes in three-space. Yao and his collaborators wrote a lot about maps of surfaces which were in that functional class. The first and second derivative were both in L2. And it isn't true that those are continuous. But on the other hand, it's still possible with a lot of cleverness to define what the map on fundamental group would have been if it had been continuous. So
that's the case of the kind of a two-dimensional path integral? You said membranes?
Yeah, I think this is when they were studying minimal surfaces in three space. But I think typically you're...
If you're going to go one dimension higher, it's going to be...
It's going to be less.
Less smooth.
Yeah, right. I think that's the way it goes. But you may still be able to, by some cleverness, figure out that pi 1 is still a functor, or at least H1 or something like that.
You may. I'm just saying that I think you might hope optimistically for Dave's program that maybe it wouldn't be too soon. The measure might blur out this infinite sequence that approaches the cusp.
Yeah.
Maybe they all...
I had a similar thought. It was too vague, and I didn't want to mention it, but whether there's some kind of notion of a quantum cutoff which prevents you from understanding the difference between a compact manifold that almost has a cusp and and one that really does have a cusp. And maybe this could save the day. Maybe if you quantize things in some way and you can't see all the distinctions. I mean, I'm thinking of like spin, or, if classical spin, it can point in any direction. But if you, look at like spin 3/2 particle or something, you only have four directions of spin. So maybe there's some way of quantizing, the hyperbolic manifolds or the classical thing, but when you quantize, all these infinities are stripped away.
Shall we call it an afternoon?
I had a lot of fun.
Me too. Thank you.
Thank you, audience.
So this will appear on YouTube later today.